It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Well, welcome to the Jason in the House podcast. I'm Jason Chaffetz, surprisingly enough. And this week, we're going to talk a little bit about the news. Highlight the stupid, because as we like to say, there's always somebody doing something stupid somewhere. And then we're going to phone a friend. And this time, we're going to give a call and shout out to Ashley Webster. Now, Ashley, I think you may have seen him on, if you watch Varney, if you watch Fox Business, if you want to get some insight as to what's going on in the world of finance and whatnot, there's no finer person than Ashley Webster. He knows his stuff. He's a fun, happy person. I've got to know him and interact with him, shared a lot of laughs. But you know what? I don't know a lot about his background and how he suddenly, you know, somehow, some way, I shouldn't say suddenly, but how he ended up at Fox Business. He's just a wonderful human being. He's got that British accent. We're going to learn a little bit more about that, I hope. But I'm always fascinated by people who do well, and I love people who are just happy warriors. And Ashley certainly falls into that category, one of the best in the business. So look forward to having that conversation with Ashley. But let's talk a little bit about the news, because I think one of the things we're going to get into, Ashley, and talk about is the passing of the Queen of England. And I got to tell you, you know, we make a lot of jokes. We kind of mock sometimes the monarchy and whatnot. But I've always had the greatest respect for the Queen of England. What she did and her impact on the world, what she's seen in her 70 years and the cohesiveness and the clarity and the respect and honor that she gave that office, her view of the world, her impact on the world, her steady hand in the world, has been a great asset to the United States of America, been a great asset for freedom and prosperity. And I was sad to see her pass. I know the people and our friends that have ties to the UK are really feeling it, but I can tell you on the other side of the pond here in the United States of America, I was really sad to see this happen. I mean, it was inevitable. She was up in her 90s. People, that happens. But I just thought she was a pillar for freedom, a pillar for respect and honor and dignity, and she dealt with some of the toughest times, particularly early in her reign, you know, dealing with World War II and what England went through, and then throughout the course of history and time. And I'm sure with a new king and a new predecessors after that, things are going to change up a little bit. But in a world of that's tumultuous, that has so many ups and downs, I think the Queen was a steady hand that I had the greatest respect for, and sad to see her pass along. And I hope we can learn the lessons and hear the stories and understand her perspective, because I thought she did. She was just a wonderful person in a really pivotal time throughout world history. Nobody's quite seen it for as long and as up close and as personal as she did. And I was sad to see her pass. All right. Now I got to go to another thing that I saw on FoxNews.com. I almost put this in the category of stupid, but, you know, the other end of the spectrum, talking about the Queen, to hear Vice President Kamala Harris talking about the border. This is the quote that she had, as was said in FoxNews.com. I think there's no question that we have to do what the president and I asked Congress to do. The first request we made, pass a bill to create a pathway to citizenship. Of course, she's talking about immigration. She went on to say, the border is secure, but we also have a broken immigration system, in particular over the last 4 years, because we came in and it needs to be fixed. What a bunch of garbage that is. That is the most offensive statement I can possibly imagine. First of all, she's taken no time and effort to get to know the Border Patrol, understand what they're going through, and to look at the metrics, because there is not a single metric out there that suggests that the border is secure. It is offensive to suggest it is secure. I've heard Alejandro Mayorkas, the Secretary of Homeland Security, say there's operational control and that the border's secure. I've heard the White House spokesperson say the border is secure. It is not secure. They're flowing over here by the thousands every day. Encounters are up over 2 million. 2 million in a 12-month period. 2 million. And, folks, those are just the ones that, you know, we're aware of. Imagine all the ones that we don't see and don't catch and aren't aware of that are getting here through so many means. It is absolutely controlled by the drug cartels. It's human trafficking. It's drug trafficking. It's fundamentally wrong. And the Biden-Harris administration has tacitly approved of this by getting rid of dozens and dozens and dozens of rules, regulations, and putting into policies that have acted as a magnet for people to come here illegally. Now, there are some people in the world that are legitimately, under the law, claiming asylum, and they need to be dealt with. And let's also remember that legally and lawfully, more people come to the United States of America legally and lawfully than all other countries do in immigration combined. You can't go into Mexico the way people come into the United States. You can't do that. But more than 1 million times a year, people will legally and lawfully come into this country. And, you know, I think we're failing the people that are trying to do it legally and lawfully, because those are the people that get in line. They don't cut. They don't do all the things that they shouldn't do. They're doing it legally and lawfully. And it's sad to see what's happening here. But for this Vice President of the United States to literally say the border is secure and we have a broken immigration system and that Donald Trump broke it is absurd. It is absolutely absurd. Of course, the Biden-Harris administration has no plan. They have no piece of legislation. One quick note, and maybe you've heard me say this before. I was on the immigration subcommittee when I first got to Congress, 2009, 2010. During the Obama years, and you know what? I asked to be on the immigration subcommittee there in Judiciary. Democrats never introduced an immigration bill, and they didn't think there was any urgency. They're just trying to cater and pander to a group of people. But you know what? There's a reason why Hispanics, in large part, are flowing to the Republican side of the aisle in numbers like we've never seen before. Because the people that I know that fall into that category of they want law and order. They want there to be a secure system and a secure border. Those are the people that I know. And again, I think we're failing. Also, when you look at the border, it's not just about people from Mexico or Central or South America. That makes up the majority. But if you go and look at the detention numbers and the apprehension numbers, it's over 150 countries. Everybody around the world knows you want to get into the United States without having to get in line. All you need to do is get down to the southern border, flow north, and the odds are you're not going to be caught. And if you do get caught, you're going to get released. That's the way it is under Biden and Harris. And that's why the numbers are at record high. And that's why the 20,000 plus people in the Border Patrol are just, I mean, what they're doing, how they're doing it, it's just absolutely, it's just wrong, just fundamentally wrong. All right. Last thing I want to mention in the news before we bring on the stupid is we're starting to find out now the deal that Joe Manchin made. Joe Manchin, we thought, was going to hold the line on the Inflation Reduction Act. You know, the one that doesn't really reduce inflation, the one that is a $739 billion climate and tax package. That's what it is. It's the Green New Deal parsed off in a different way, $739 billion. Well, price tag evidently for Joe Manchin's vote was $6.6 billion. The Mountain Valley Pipeline, it's a 304-mile West Virginia to Virginia natural gas pipeline. it was under construction, but there were all these permitting problems and Endangered Species Protection Act problems. So they weren't able to complete that. And what Joe Manchin wanted to do is complete that pipeline. Now, I applaud that. Sounds good. I don't know much about the pipeline other than, yeah, if it's needed to move things safely, securely, with something that's cleaner than what we've been doing in the past, hey, let's do that. But Joe Manchin sold his soul and sold his vote for the completion of this. Now, some on the ultra-liberal left who think the world is going to end, you know, year after next, they are not wanting to allow Joe Manchin to complete this deal. So the White House and Chuck Schumer in a little bit of a pickle. They didn't reveal this deal until, you know, after the fact, after the other deal passed. That's the way Chuck Schumer works around here. But I got to tell you, this pipeline, the Mountain Valley Pipeline, it better be a good one, because Joe Manchin sold us short here and put us all in further debt to numbers that are absolutely stunning. All right, time to bring on the stupid, because you know what? There's always somebody doing something stupid somewhere. So let's bring on the stupid. All right, for this stupid, we just need to go to New Orleans Mayor LaToya Cantrell. She's a Democrat, and she's facing a little scrutiny, as she should. So the New Orleans mayor decided that for her safety, she needed to travel first class as opposed to the back of the airplane or the coach part of the plane. And she has racked up thousands and thousands of dollars, claiming it's for security. Listen to what she said, okay? Now, keep in mind, in January, Cantrell, Mayor Cantrell, flew first class from New Orleans to Washington, D.C. The ticket cost $2,300. In March, she flew from, this is crazy, New Orleans to Miami, which isn't that far, right? She flew first class to Miami, $2,800. But here's where it gets really interesting, because in June, she traveled to Switzerland, first class, $9,800. And of course, in July, she had to go, the mayor of New Orleans had to go to France, $17,000 ticket, $17,000, the flight to France from New Orleans. Now, put in perspective that evidently the starting salary for a New Orleans police department is $40,000. But anyway, this was all based on an interview that Todd Pirro did on Fox and Friends First. And the numbers are stunning. So here, what does the mayor say? What does the mayor say in order to justify this? Quote, "My travel accommodations are a matter of safety, not of luxury. As all women know, our health and safety are often disregarded, and we are left to navigate alone." End quote. You know what? I got some breaking news. Navigating on an airplane is done by the pilot and the co-pilot. Sometimes the navigator's up there, too. So the amazing thing about when you get on an airplane is that you don't actually have to do the navigation, and that everybody passes through security. And that everybody who gets on that plane starts and ends at the same place. I know this is a revelation to the mayor of New Orleans, but she doesn't have to do the navigation. There is a security check. And if she travels with the security detail, okay, maybe she needs to have somebody fly with her to help carry her bag. But guess what, Madam Mayor? You don't need to do this as a matter of safety. And to say, "And we are left to navigate alone." No, the airlines take care of that. They actually do the navigation of the plane. That's why this qualifies as stupid. New Orleans Mayor LaToya Cantrell fleecing the people of New Orleans and using money inappropriate, $17,000 to fly to France. Give me a break. All right, that's bringing on the stupid. All right, now it's time to phone a friend, Ashley Webster. Ashley, I'm really looking forward to this. He's just a great guy and full of energy. So let's dial up Ashley.
Hello?
Ashley, hey, Jason Chaffetz.
Hey, Jason, how are you?
Thanks so much for joining me on this podcast. You know what? My time at Fox, I've really enjoyed kind of getting to know you, but I've never had an in-depth conversation about your background and how you, you know, it's always interesting to me how you cross paths with people, and I'm glad I've crossed in your path, but just want to talk about you, your life, how you got to where you're at, because you got a fascinating background.
It's a strange one, that's for sure. Born and raised in England for 20-something years, came to the United States in the 1980s with mom and dad. I was an only child. Dad was a banker, as was my mother, by the way. When they ended up in Los Angeles, my father was offered a job in Los Angeles. So we loaded up the, you know, all our belongings and headed west. And it's been a wild ride since then. I went to Cal State Northridge in Los Angeles. I fell into journalism. Literally, someone said, oh, you should work on the campus radio station. So I said, oh, that could be fun. So I did that and found I absolutely loved it, doing the local news breaks. And then someone said, when I came around to graduation, oh, I got a friend up in Montana. He works for an NBC station up there. You should give him a call. I think he's got an opening. And lo and behold, I loaded up the car and drove to Helena, Montana for my very first job and absolutely loved it.
Well, let's go. I mean, that's great because it finally led you to Fox Business. But let's go back to Brighton, right? That's where you were growing up in England?
Brighton, England. It's directly south from London on the south coast. It was always, if you want to get to the beach from London, Brighton's the quickest. Just go straight down on the train. The fast train will get you there in under 50 minutes. And it was a fun place to grow up. It had a couple of piers. It was always that kind of seaside resort type of a feel. And I loved growing up there. I went to school there. I got my first jobs there. So I feel I had a great childhood. I was very lucky.
So what was your first job? And I mean, first job like away from mom and dad, other than, hey, Ashley, take the door job.
I did a paper round when I was 10. My first job was as a teller, a bank teller for Lloyd's Bank. I was 16 years old. Now, remember, back in the UK, unless you wanted to stay to go on to university, you would you could leave school at 16, which is what I did. Mortified my parents, who of course wanted me to go on, become this big scholar. Wasn't me. I was into sports, and that's all I concentrated on. I got out of school at 16, became a teller for Lloyd's Bank. I had another job as a bartender in the evenings on a boat in a marina, believe it or not. So I was working two jobs
as a 16-year-old.
As a 16-year-old, oh yes, yes.
I mean, you can do that UK, in England. Serve drinks age. At 16 years old.
Drinking age was 16 then, so I remember working the bar on a Saturday night. It'd be three deep with three rows of people shouting and waving money at you. But it was good. I thoroughly enjoyed it as a young man. And I moved to London when I was 18, and I worked for the Bank of Montreal, of all places, in their dividends department. But to be honest with you, Mum worked for the Bank of England, Dad worked for Lloyd's Bank, and I suddenly realized at that early stage, banking was never going to be for me. So when we moved to the States, it was an opportunity for me to kind of push the reset button. And I'm forever grateful for that.
Now, what kind of, you said sports was occupying a lot of your young mind. What sport were you playing?
Soccer was my religion, and I played for the school, and I played for another team, a community team on weekends out of school. And I played a lot. I mean, it was my life. I went to the local soccer pro team and supported them every other Saturday when they played at home, and then followed them away. I had trials for professional teams, and I had a trial for my home team. And I remember it was a pouring down rain Sunday afternoon, and I was playing in front of some pretty important people. And I thought I had a good game. You know, I created a goal, and that was the end of that. They said, thanks, but no thanks. I think my father was more, upset than I was. But it was one of those things. I also played a lot of cricket. I also had tryouts for pro cricket for Sussex, which was the county I lived in. I got through the second round of trials for Sussex, but again, never worked out. So, it wasn't to be, but to this day, I'm sports nuts. I love baseball, American football, anything that's on television, on ESPN, if it's Tiddlywinks at 3 o'clock in the morning, I'll watch it.
I have this good friend, Todd, who's made a living as a broadcaster over at NBC, and he specializes in the oddest of sports. Like, he's the guy that you turn on in the middle of the night, and it's like, you know, weightlifting, but with a twist of bowling, you know. It was like, and, and he's like the expert on it. And I haven't talked to him in a while, but every once in a while, I'll see him and I'll, you know, shoot him a text and say,
please,
hey,
please thank him for me, because I'm the one watching.
There are a lot of people out there late at night watching that. So do you still follow the football, F-U-T-B-O-L?
Absolutely. My home team, Brighton. Brighton is the only one team that I followed. You know, back in the day, they were in the much lower leagues. They never were in the glamour league of the Liverpools and the Man Uniteds and Man Cities. They always played in the lower leagues, but that was okay. I thoroughly enjoyed it. As I say, I used to travel the country following them. And but now I live in America, of course. What do? They get really good and are now in the English Premier League and are doing very well. But I still follow them. I can watch every game on TV here in the US, which I find amazing. I'm up to speed on everything thanks to social media and everything else these days.
Well, truth be told, I much rather watch an English Premier League game than anything else. I really
good
do
for
enjoy
you.
It.
Yeah,
I mean, I kind of pick teams here and there, but yeah. I don't have the heartfelt loyalty that you and some others that grew up with them, and then you'll never, you know, lifelong fans.
My father took me when I think I was 6 or 7 to my first game. So we're talking late 60s. And it's been a painful experience ever since, because when you follow Brighton, you're just used to disappointment and heartache. And to see the heights they've reached now is you know, I'm desperate sometimes just to talk to someone here and realize that no one understands how crazy it is that Brighton are close to the top of the Premier League. It's hilarious.
Yeah, well, you should try being a Canary fan up there, like some people I know. I mean, there are ups and downs, and then there are teams that are usually down. So, yeah.
Yes, that's true.
But it is the way people follow football in Europe is
so crazy.
Different than the way we follow maybe an NFL team or a college team. I mean, we have fanatics, and people that really get into it year after year.
Sure.
They're very supportive. But I'm just saying, as a whole, I wish people could understand and see and kind of experience the loyalty and how the up and down of the entire community, the whole city, the whole spirit of the community can rise and fall based on a match.
That's exactly right. And places like Liverpool, it's split between Liverpool and Everton, two Premier League games. Obviously, Liverpool, the more famous, but Liverpool play in red, Everton play in blue, and there are houses painted red and blue all over the city. You know, you're left in no doubt as who you support. But yes, the only place in America that I must say that I've found that kind of fanaticism is, but I lived in Green Bay, Wisconsin for 3 years. I worked for the NBC affiliate there, and being a sports nut, it was a real opportunity to get into the Packer legend and lore, and that was crazy. That was remarkable. And they won the Super Bowl when I was there, so I was very lucky to experience that.
You're listening to Jason in the House. We'll be back with more of my conversation with Ashley Webster right after this.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network, stay on top of the latest news and information from Fox News. Listen and download the Fox News Hourly Update on your time. The trending stories you need anytime you want it. Listen and download now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
So you're in Southern California. Next thing you know, you're going to Montana. I mean, what kind of culture shock was that? I mean, not just the weather, but that's a whole lot different than Brighton, England, and Los Angeles, California.
Every day, I thought I was in a movie. It's. I mean, you know, Utah, obviously, Montana, big sky country. That sky is absolutely enormous. And I remember coming into town. I skidded straight through a red light because I had a rear wheel drive car, and it was all ice. It was in February. I went straight through the light, and I thought, this is going to be different. But I got to tell you, Helena was a town of about 28,000. It was the state capital, a lot of white collar workers, but also surrounded by farms and ranches. And some of my best experiences were there. You know, I remember very early on, they asked me to MC a rodeo, and they put me in a 10-gallon hat and gave me a microphone. And I just, you should have seen the look on the people's faces when I started calling this rodeo. And they all kind of stopped and turned around and looked into the announcer's booth and like, who the hell is this guy? Who are you? You know,
yeah.
I didn't know what to say. I was like, here's another horse that doesn't want the guy on his back trying to bunk him off, apparently. And, you know, they had me doing the sheep busting stuff. And I had the time of my life. And I still look back at that very fondly. It was a great time. I thoroughly enjoyed it. The winters were brutal. But I will tell you, when I was there, I got to know the local authorities very well. And I remember one day in the newsroom, I get a call from, his name was Chuck O'Reilly, the Lewis and Clark County Sheriff, of which Helena was in. He goes, hey, Ash, guess who's with me? And I said, I have no idea. You know, Jimmy Hoffa. And he goes, Unabomber? I said, I beg your pardon? And that, the Unabomber. And I laughed down the phone. He said, I'm dead serious. And then that created one of the most memorable days of my life. And I remember I got a tip off that Ted Kaczynski was going to be bought out of one office in Helena, that everyone thought he was going to be bought somewhere else. It was just me and one photographer from Seattle who got the famous video, and he was still looking wild as he was being walked down the street. And if you look, I'm wearing the blue and white jacket, so I'm on the other guy's video.
Really?
But that's one of those, yeah, it's one of those moments. I remember looking at him saying, Ted, are you the Unabomber? And he just looked straight through me. And I have a very interesting knack of being in the right place at the right time, which is why I think news is my gig. When I was living in LA, actually I was living in Yuma, Arizona. I've been everywhere, Jason. I was working for the ABC in Yuma, Arizona. I was coming back to visit my parents on a Friday afternoon, and I got stuck in that whole OJ mess on the 405 freeway. Can you believe that? I remember all of a sudden there were helicopters above and there was people running on the highway, and I was like, what the heck? Turned on the radio. And so I got stuck in the middle of that. So again, very lucky when it comes to news.
Yeah. I mean, if you spent time in Brighton, LA, Yuma, yep. Helena, that's not a traditional path that people take to have a successful broadcasting.
And don't forget Green Bay. I went from Yuma, where the highest temperature when I was there was 122.
Right.
And I moved from there to Green Bay. And I had a young daughter at the time who was so used to touching the slides and swings in playgrounds because you didn't want to burn yourself. So she would touch it quickly to make sure it wasn't, you know, too hot that you should get burned. She goes to Green Bay where, you know, you're stuck indoors for 6 months of the year with the temperature well below zero.
Wow. And so what do you attribute this success to? I mean, look, a lot of people, I mean, there might be tellers out there that, you know, have a little background, but then, you know, I find that there are a lot of people that want to do these things, but they don't necessarily get to do these things or don't have the opportunity. What was the difference, do you think?
I love meeting people, and I love finding out about what people do. I have a real passion for it, and I think I just found the right job, and I came across some really great people. I was told many times, I must say, straight out of college, and then as I was trying to move onwards and upwards, you know, climb the big ladder of television news, oh, well, you know, in America, they like you to sound like you come from Kansas, you know, middle of the country. And if they know you're not local, then they can't connect to you. And I always thought, well, okay. So I ignored it and I just kept going. And so I was the English guy that was anchoring the late night news in Green Bay. And then I became the English guy doing the news for the Fox affiliate. I was the main anchor for the Fox affiliate in Nashville for 10 years. Now, I'm clearly not from Nashville. And what was great about that was everywhere I went, they'd say, where y'all from? And I used to look at them deadpan. I'd answer, Kentucky. And they would look through me and they'd say, really? And I'd say, well, Eastern Kentucky, but yes. I think it speaks, Jason, to the generosity of Americans. I mean, I've been all over this country, as you can tell, and everywhere I've been received remarkably well because clearly I'm not a local. But I made it a point to learn all the local issues, get to know people, take part in community events, and really become a part of that community and thoroughly enjoyed every minute of it.
Well, and then you were involved, right, in the financial markets. I mean, you're
yes. I mean, I had that background. Yeah, and when I was after 10 years in Nashville, someone put me in touch and said, "Hey, you know what? Fox is starting a new business channel. You should give them a call. It'd be great for you." And so I thought, oh, I don't know. And I'd never had an agent or anything, and I thought, well, maybe. So I did it anyway on a whim, and next thing you know, being flown out to New York, I got to meet all the big muckety-mucks at Fox there on 1211 6th Avenue, and within a short period of time, they sent me back to England. So I did the big circle from Brighton, cashier, teller, all the way to L.A., Helena, Yuma. By the way, I forgot, I also worked in Eureka, California, in Northern California, right up there on the Oregon border. So I'd been all over the country. And then, of course, I ended up getting sent back to England to cover Europe for Fox Business Network when it launched in 2007. So it's been a really interesting ride. I was there in London for 3 years, covered all of Europe and the Middle East. And then they said, hey, we would like you to come back to New York if you're interested. We would like you to do some anchoring and doing some work out of the New York office. And I said, sure, sounds great. And so I came back. So it's been a remarkable, remarkable journey. And really, when I think about it, Jason, I can't even believe I've done it. So it's one of those things, if you think too much about it, it's all going to go wrong. So you just keep going.
So how long have you been back in New York?
I've been back in New York from London now. Oh, let me see. I came back 12 years. I was London for three. Okay. Yeah, and I've been with the network 15 years.
And what was it like going back to London, having, you know, been spent so much time in the U.S.? Did you have
English
or a U.S. accent, or did they?
My friends just said, oh, my God, listen to John Wayne. Yeah. I, of course, didn't think I'd lost my accent at all, but they just teased me mercilessly. And it was it was weird to go back. You know, it was familiar, but it wasn't familiar. But in the end, you get used to it. I got to go to my football games again, and I like the pubs. I like the, the social gatherings in the UK. But I certainly missed the US, and when I had the chance to come back, I did. So, and I became an American citizen, I think, back in 1997, and I actually did that in Montana. I went back to Montana to go through that ceremony, and it was me and two other people, someone from the Czech Republic and I think someone from Switzerland. Now, if I did that in Los Angeles, it would be me and 5,000 other people in the convention center. So I was very glad I went through that process in Montana. It was very special.
Yeah, I love the people in Montana. It's one of my favorite places to go. You know, I'm fortunate out west here. I go to Wyoming, Idaho, Montana, Colorado, Arizona. I mean, I'm kind of an Intermountain West guy.
I used to drive all the way. What's the interstate that goes all the way through Utah? I've driven it many times. I-15. I used to take I-15 from Helena. I used to drive to L.A. Can you believe that? 23 hours and through the entire state of Utah. But I felt like I knew Utah very, very well. I've been to all the national parks. I was just in Moab last fall and absolutely loved it. And and a weird thing was back in when Atlanta had the Summer Olympics, I was working for an NBC station still in Montana, and they said, hey, would you like to go run the Olympic torch? And I said, yeah, that would be great, you know, just do a leg of it. And the nearest place to me was Salt Lake City. So I got on a Delta flight down to Salt Lake, and I actually ran a leg in downtown Salt Lake when the Olympic torch came through. And while I was doing that, I was getting a little winded. I like to run. I've done a couple of marathons, but I was getting a little winded. And a cop on a motorbike comes up to me, and he's riding along. And he goes, how are you feeling? And I said, good. Why? What's wrong? He goes, well, the person you're going to pass it on to is not going to make it. So can you do another leg?
No.
So suddenly the pressure was on. I didn't want to be the guy.
How far a distance is that?
It's not that far. I'm trying to remember how much it was. It was probably maybe a half mile now instead of a quarter mile. But I was paranoid. I'm going to be the guy that was going to trip and put the Olympic flame out. So
there's a way to make the evening news. Yeah, you don't want to be one making the news by carrying the torch and dropping the torch. So, Oh, that's
so
great.
Yeah, but that's another connection to Salt Lake City. I love Utah. I've had so much fun there.
Well, that's good because we got a beautiful state, and that Moab area was part of my congressional district the whole time.
Was it really?
In Congress, yeah.
Oh.
And so, you know, I always had to go down there, which that's a tough call right there.
Yeah, the National Arches, I was there and spent some time in Moab itself. And what a unique and you know, the landscape is remarkable.
What, again, going back to early on, I mean, you tell your parents, hey, I'm going to go off to Yuma. What was the first one away from Los Angeles? Was it Yuma?
Helena, Montana.
Helena. Hey, Mom, Dad. I got this great gig. It pays. My guess is it probably didn't pay maybe what?
I can tell you exactly. It was paid $10,800 a year.
A first year. Job. So, yeah, Mom, 10, Dad, I'm going to earn less than $1,000 a month, and it's going to be great.
Yes. Yep.
This is going to be great. And by the way, I'm going to need to take a car. Did you take a car up there?
I did. Oh, absolutely, I did.
And so, what did your parents, like, what were they really thinking?
Where is that? Canada? first reaction.
Well, pretty much said, is, well, but yes.
Yeah, I said exactly. I said as close as you can get without being Canada. They were very always been, you know, they're one of the fact that they moved to America in the late 40s shows that they're adventurous. And they just said, yeah, you know, hey, if you want to go for it, go for it. You know, why not? Get the experience, have some fun. And so that's what I did and never looked back. And they've loved my profession because they've always come to every place I've lived. It's given them an opportunity to see America as well. My father, well, both of my parents fell in love with Montana, so much so that they wanted to buy a house there and move there. My father's always been very interested in Native American history. He loved all of that. And so when he was up there, he had a chance to look into some of the museums and all that. He just thought it was the greatest place he'd ever been and was immediately ready to buy a house. And I said, well, this is great, but, you know, if I'm going to move up the ladder, I'm probably going to have to move on. And they're like, oh, yeah, that's true. And so was that the story? You know, I went from there to Eureka, California, and then from Eureka, I went to Yuma, Arizona, from Yuma to Green Bay, Wisconsin, from Green Bay to Nashville, and then from Nashville to New York. But along the way, I mean, Nashville itself, 10 years there, what a city that was. And the people were so, so lovely. Country music people are the friendliest people on earth. I mean, they are very genuine people who took me in. So, yeah, I mean, my parents have had a great ride as well.
You know, it's true. The people, the country music fans, the people live in that part of the country, they love their country. They love people. Yes. They're happy people. And they love their country and they love their country music.
They do. I got to know, you know, the late Charlie Daniels very well. And he said to me one day, he said, hey, I'm going to go tour. I'm going to go to Bosnia and Kosovo. And he said, would you like to come? I said, yeah. So we went, we took a crew and flew with him. He went to Wiesbaden to visit some injured troops at Landstuhl Hospital there in Germany. And then from there, we flew to Kosovo and he did a free concert for a UN camp there with multinational troops. And we just got to tag along. So, you know, hang out with Charlie and his band, the nicest people you will ever meet. So yeah, it's been a real privilege to get a front row seat to this stuff.
Yeah, you know, Charlie Daniels, I was sorry to see him pass. I had a chance a couple of years ago, I guess it's been a couple of years now, where I was the guest host on Fox and Friends. I think it was one of his very last interviews. The way it all lined up, I got to do this interview with Charlie Daniels I could have talked to him for hours, but you know, it's you gotta keep moving on TV. But and I thought, and then he passed away fairly shortly thereafter, and I thought, wow, that's that, you know, it was one of the last, if not the last, interviews that he had done. And
wow,
it was neat. But to go travel overseas with him, that would have been a special moment. He was a great individual and entertained an awful lot of people.
One last memory of Charlie is we were in Germany. We were out one night and he said, oh, let's go to the beer keller. You know, let's go and have some drinks with them. So we all kind of bundled down into this German drinking hall. And there was a big bell at the front door with a clanger. And he immediately grabs it and rings it as loud as he can. And the whole place erupts. And everyone's jumping up and down and cheering. And he goes, I guess I'm popular here. And it turns out if you do that, you buy a drink for everyone in the beer hall.
Yeah, you get and popular you know real quick, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
Well, Charlie could probably afford it.
Oh, yeah.
That's funny. That is really funny.
Yeah.
So through this career, and you look back on it, you got young people that, hey, I wish I could do that. I want to give that a go. What advice would you give them? What's the difference between making it, not making it? What does it take? And look, some people, this is not going to work out for them. But if they wanted to get in television or radio, what would you say to them?
Well, both. I started in radio, believe it or not. My first really important internship was at CBS Radio in LA, and that really got me on the path. But my best advice, and I've seen this time and again working in all these different places, if you really love it and you're prepared to put in the really hard slog. I mean, I was carrying my own camera. I was shooting my own stand-ups. I was bringing that stuff back, editing it, and then anchoring it on air. You do everything. And that was great training. Those people who get into it because they think, oh, this could be kind of cool, I'm going to be on TV, they generally drop out within a year, if not sooner, because that's not what it is. You have to have a real passion for the job. You have to have people skills. You have to really want to know what's going on. You have to be nosy. I'm a nosy kind of guy. I love to be the person that knows before everyone else what's going on. And you never lose that. And I think for people out there, young people who want to get into it, if you have a passion, go out there, just do it. Don't be afraid. Dare to be great and be prepared to work long hours and working really hard when you start for not great money, but hang in there because it gets better as you go along.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of it is you're gonna have to show that you really want it. And part of really wanting it is making zero money, barely covering expenses. And then you're right. You got to carry your own sticks, your own camera. You got to cut the tape. You got to do all of that.
But you know what? That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's one of those professions where you can't just show up and say, yeah, let's start talking, you know? And
yeah, no.
How do you deal with, you know, one of the things now that I've had a chance to be able to guest host and do that, there's so many moving parts, you know, and I see you on Varney, for instance, a lot and guest hosting for Stewart as well.
Yeah.
And the volatility and, you know, prompters coming up, stuff you haven't seen before, markets are moving, you don't know what's happening, you know, but you had such clarity and such your ability to synthesize and grasp all of that and then succinctly be able to do it without stumbling over it is truly a talent.
Well, thank you very much. You know, not always. We all have bad days. And it's funny, you know, you can feel it when you're not really, you know, in sync. But for the most part, Jason, I think it's just doing it and doing it and doing it. And after you've done it for many years, it starts to become familiar to the point where you can, no matter what happens. And, you know yourself, things don't work. A live camera goes down or someone's audio doesn't work. It's okay. I actually like those moments because I think it proves to the viewer we are live and things don't go perfectly all of the time. And you got a producer in your ear who's saying, yeah, whatever, get to the break, quick, you know, wrap it up. That's all part of it. I love it. It's like you're a traffic cop and you're trying to direct all these different lanes of traffic, making sure no one hits each other. And I think that's part of the appeal. I mean, it's like you're a conductor almost, and you're just trying to make sure that everything goes the way it's supposed to go. And the people behind the scenes, to be honest with you, are amazing. The amount of work they put in, no one knows what goes, an hour's worth of television with all the videotape and all the audio and the live interviews and all the graphics that go into a show. It's a real, real team effort. And I'm not just saying it really is. And so everyone has to be on their game. I mean, if the guy in audio has a bad day, I'm not going to look good, you know?
Yeah, no, it's so true. You know, I remember having a conversation about this with Sean Hannity. And I said, Sean, you know, and so what do people not understand or not appreciate? You know, because he does 4 hours of radio, then he does television. And it's just tremendous. He said people have no idea about how much preparation it takes because you just can't show up and do an hour of television after doing hours of radio and then just wing it. I mean, next time you watch a show, watch how many graphics and you know, the little Chiron's coming on. And then there's an audio clip, and then there's what's called an element that you can call for. And then there's a SOT, a sound over tape, where you call for something and there's audio, and you can't step on top of that. And then and then sometimes you're the guest, and the person who's interviewing is asking a question, but the producer decides, hey, I'm going to get in your ear and tell you that, hey, you need to kind of speed up. Let's make sure that this is, you know, a quick answer. And you're like, you know, I can't hear the question, right? You understand that when you're talking to me, I can't hear what they're saying.
Exactly.
Some are
they're
better at it than others.
Out.
But,
yeah.
But, you know, at Fox, they're such professionals, and it's such, you know, the highest of levels that you get really good quality stuff. And
they are great. They're
but things go wrong.
Machine. They do go wrong, and that's okay because that's life. But I would say 9 times out of 10, they don't. And they're very good at what they do.
Yeah, no. It is fun, and you got to have banter and laugh at yourself and just keep rolling with it. Otherwise, nobody wants to see somebody with a sour face getting mad at somebody.
No, don't ever take it. Don't ever take yourself too seriously. Self-deprecation is a very important part of television.
Yeah.
Because if you think you're more important than anyone else, you're very we're all replaceable. That's a fact of life, and never forget that. And, people think TV is all about big egos. Sure, there are egos out there, but bottom line, the people who do it day in and day out and do it well, they understand how it all works. And you have to be humble, because, my God, television can make you humble.
Yeah. You're listening to Jason in the House. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Before I get to the rapid questions, which I know you're anxious to get to, everybody
ready.
Was telling me that you're really excited about that part of this. But tell me about your, we just had the passing of the Queen. And she was an iconic figure. But, I'm not from England. I watched her from afar with great admiration. I have nothing but positive things to say about her. And her life and her impact on the world. But as somebody who's from there, what's your perspective on?
Growing up with royalty, and of course it was the Queen, was on the throne when I was born, and that's all I've ever known. And the reverence that goes with it, it's just part of British society. I listened to someone the other day who said that the best way to describe it to an American audience is the Queen is like what the United States flag is to Americans. It has the same reverence, the same sense of importance, and it's what holds this country together. It's what this is all about. And that's a pretty good description. I have tremendous respect for Queen Elizabeth, the late Queen Elizabeth. I think she did an amazing job. It's an absolute, would you want to be in that position? 70 years of pure public service. You sacrifice your own life for that. She never wanted to be queen. She was thrown into it through a series of events going back to Edward VIII and the abdication and then her father and so on. So she was stuck at the age of 25 becoming queen. And what a remarkable job she did. She weathered some tough times from, World War II at the end of that came to an end in 1945. And when she took over, the country was still the UK was very much in trying to rebuild, was in a bad shape. And she got the country through that. And she became just a symbol of stability, consistency, and I think a lot of grace. And I'm a huge, huge fan. There are Republicans, those who don't want the royal family. I'm not one of them, but I'm a little older. I think if you poll people in England, I think the last poll I saw was 77% of people over 65 are very much in favor of the royal family. But if you get to the 18 to 24-year-olds, they don't have that same reference. They don't have that same reverence, if you like. And they feel that taxpayers in the UK should not be paying a family who's already very rich, and they'll make their arguments. For me personally, I think it's important. It's a part of tradition, and it rises above everything else. And it's what makes Britain Britain, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, it's really worked, and I think you're right. I think the word that you used that I associate with her is the grace, and the tumultuous times that the world has gone through, and the steady hand that she's offered I don't think anybody's properly prepared to take on such a mantle, but to do so with such steadiness for 7 years. I mean, there's nobody else in history like that.
No, not at all. And you know, the memories I have, I mean, Christmas Day was always 3 o'clock in the afternoon on BBC. Everything, no matter what chaos was going on in the house and presents everywhere and food and everything, everyone settled down for the Queen's speech at 3 o'clock on Christmas Day. And it was one of those things where it just became, you just knew you were going to sit down. And it was always a short speech, maybe 8 minutes, something like that. But she was always so on point and always so delivered so perfectly. And it just made you feel good about yourself and the country.
Well, I think the world's going to miss her in many, many ways.
Yes.
And thanks for sharing that. On the other end of the spectrum, I need to ask you some rapid questions.
Bring it on.
You ready? You're sitting down?
Yes.
Okay. All right,
I'm
put that seatbelt on. All right, first concert you attended.
A band called Slade at the Brighton Dome. Slade, they were a band that did so many great songs that everyone else copied, and you think that the band that copied it actually did the song, but it was Slade. So there you go.
Can't say I've heard of Slade, but yeah, I'm glad you did that.
Yeah.
Now, what was your the equivalent of high school? What was your mascot?
It's not like American schools. I went to somewhere called Brighton College. And you're going to say, what? It's a college? Well, it was a college.
No, but that's how they do. Yeah, that's why I said the equivalent, because, yeah, it's different.
Yeah, it is different. We didn't
Did you have a mascot?
We have school colors, and the school colors are important. They're blue and burgundy. Ours were colors, and that's the color of your school tie.
And you had a crest. Did you have a crest?
Yes, and there was a crest too, and a Latin saying. And God, you're going to kill me for this, but I cannot remember the Latin. I think in something about in truth, in God, and then in truth, I believe, something along those lines. But you'll have a crest, you'll have the colors, and you'll have a Latin phrase to go with the crest. And that's how it was done in those days.
All right. Favorite vegetable?
Broccoli.
Bold answer. That's I'm proud
Very
of you
bold.
For just actually naming a vegetable, because not everybody
my
does
wife
that on
just
this
walked,
podcast.
My wife just walked by and laughed because she knows I'm lying. I was doing it to impress her.
All right. So if you had a chance to meet Bigfoot, what would you ask him?
How do you stay invisible? Which is funny because I just met him. But how come, and I want to believe it, but how come no one has actually had proof of him? Because
yeah,
so many
I think
people
I would want to ask
it.
Him, is that really you in this video?
Yes,
come on, let me show you some video. Tell me if that's you or not.
Oh, wouldn't that be great?
I don't know. I'm enamored with Bigfoot. I think the whole
genre too.
Around it just makes me smile. It just really does.
Have you been to Skinwalker Ranch?
No. Now, that's out in eastern Utah. It was not in my congressional district, but
I did
watch the, was it, Netflix special about it? Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of creepy. Kind of weird.
Yeah,
I know the people. I know the owner of the facility. That would be kind of interesting. Maybe I should do a podcast with him. That might be kind of interesting.
You should. So, that would be fantastic.
Did you have a pet growing up?
Yes. My first cat named George, who was just the most classic cat ever, and a rabbit named Silky.
A rabbit? That's
yes. Good. Yes, it didn't work out. Silky turned out to be an aggressive male bunny who started eating through all the wires, and my father took him off to the local farm to join other rabbits there.
Sure, that's what happened. Yeah, I bet so. Yeah, that's
I'm still hanging on to that.
That's right. all right, so you say to your wife, hey, honey, guess what? We got a treat tonight. We're going to bring somebody over to break bread and share a little meal and a little... if you could pick anybody in history to come just hang out and get to know and have a discussion, anybody, dead or alive, who would that be?
Well, my wife is a musician at heart. She was a professional singer before she became a lawyer. So I'm music mad as well. So it would have to be from the music world. I'm trying to think of someone who, I mean, you know, someone I've always wanted to meet because we both think she's amazing is Nina Simone. Wouldn't that be great to sit down and chat with her? My wife was a jazz singer, so... I think that would be really a lot of fun.
Yeah, that would be fascinating. Big question: pineapple on pizza? Yes or no?
Yes, I'm a big fan of the Hawaiian. I know you hate me now, don't you? You're going to hang up.
Yeah, well, it's just sort of disappointing. You don't put wet fruit. Don't put wet fruit on pizza. That's all there is to it.
It tastes good.
All right. Best advice you ever got?
Never give up. That was my father. And the other one he always used to say was, this too shall pass. No matter how bad you think it is, hang in there. It will get better. And I always remind myself of those things when things do get a little tough at times.
Yeah. Everybody in life goes through hard challenges. Yeah, you're not getting through life without having hardship.
No.
And having those around you that go through hard, tough, difficult things too.
Yeah.
All right, last two questions. You've been very generous with your time. Favorite childhood toy?
Favorite childhood toy.
Just to give you reference, mine was the Stretch Armstrong. Now, I don't know that they had that in England, but...
we didn't. No, but I used to like, I guess they call them here battling tops. Do you remember those battling tops? They were like, you'd spin them and they'd go into this little kind of like... arena, and they would bounce off each other until there was one left standing. I love that thing. Couldn't get
and
enough.
The other
that.
One that reminded me, I was thinking of the Rock'em Sock'em, where the boxers.
Yes, that was cool.
You try to knock
great.
His block off, and his head would pop up. Yeah, that was a good
I'd still
toy.
Play
I could
with
still
it
play
now.
That.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, last question: if you didn't get into television, if you hadn't done that radio gig, what would you be doing?
It'd have to be in sports. I mean, I'd love to be playing sports, but I'm too old for that now. But maybe either that. There's a part of me that I'm a history buff as well. I love history. And so it would be kind of fun to be a tour guide at somewhere really famous in the world, because that would be fun. Tour guide at Buckingham Palace, tour guide at the Louvre in Paris, tour guide anywhere that, that's of historical significance. So I'd absolutely love to do that.
You know, I got a chance a couple of weeks ago to go to the Louvre, and I got to give a shout out to my guide. His name was Hugo. And I don't know how you all match up with Hugo, but this was like the best. This guy was so into it. He loved it. He was passionate. He was flamboyant about it, and I tell you, it just made it so fun and so entertaining. For 2 hours, I could have stayed with him for like 8 hours, but that's what you got to find. You got to find somebody who's passionate about it.
I
think that's
why
you're so successful at Fox and the places you've been, is that you bring a passion to it. And Ashley, we appreciate you joining us on the Jason in the House podcast. Do appreciate it.
Thank you so much for calling me. I absolutely loved it. Thank you so much, Jason.
Well, I can't thank Ashley enough. I really do appreciate it. I hope that you all have a chance to get to see him and know him a little bit better on air there in Fox Business, particularly with his great work that he does on Varney. He really does do a great job there. I hope you're able to rate this, subscribe to it, look through the other ones. I think last week we had Jared Kushner on. We got some really good podcast that if you look through the list, I think you'll also enjoy. You can also go over to foxnewspodcast.com to look at the array of things that Fox offers, but rate it, like it, subscribe to it, do all those things that we'd love for you to do. And we'll be back next week with another great interview. I'm Jason Chaffetz. This has been Jason in the House.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Janice Dean, Fox News senior meteorologist. Be sure to subscribe to the Janice Dean Podcast at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to spread the sunshine.